News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us? Just a big mistake.
Today is Monday, September 24th. I'm Morgan Yee.
And I'm Claire Eagle. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It's 5:10 and time for another full hour of independent news. Our headlines will cover local news from Metro Vancouver, provincial and federal news from across Canada, as well as news from around the world. We also have our science segment, Simply Science, with Sarah Chow, and our health segment brought to you by Dietetic Intuition. And today we will also be talking to four volunteers who this weekend participated in the Great Canadian Shoreline Cleanup. So we're very excited to have them on the show today.
All this plus your weekday weather forecast brought to you by the UBC Storm Club right here on News 101, your source for independent news.
It was reported in the UBC that BC is now the third most tuition-reliant province in Canada after Ontario and Nova Scotia. This means that a large portion of the money it takes to sustain BC's universities and colleges comes directly from tuition and other fees. Statistics Canada released a report showing that over the past decade, tuition makes up 40.3% of the funding for universities, up from around 25% in 1999. Although BC still has the fourth lowest tuition in Canada, the responsibility is largely on the student body versus government funding. Minister of Advanced Education John Yap said in reference to the low levels of government monies to put towards tuition costs, quote, "In an ideal world, we'd find ways to increase affordability. Maybe the timing is not right in terms of the funding available," end quote. The Canadian Federation of Students, however, points to other Canadian provinces which have decreased the amount of dependence on tuition, some by as much as 50% over the last 10 years. CFS chairperson Katie Marocci said, quote, "What we're seeing is an offloading of a public service onto a student demographic. Other provinces, such as Newfoundland, have been taking measures to make sure post-secondary education is affordable, and we advocate for the province of BC to do so as well. One of the biggest restrictions of people choosing not to get a post-secondary degree is financial reasons. People aren't in the position where they can pay up front or don't want to put themselves in a position of massive amounts of debt. There's an entire demographic that will be less likely to acquire a post-secondary education," end quote. And just a note, Newfoundland lowered its dependency from 30% in 1999 to 15.9% in 2009.
A $3 million donation from Goldcorp Incorporated to St. Paul's Hospital in Vancouver will be used to provide specialized training regarding addiction to doctors. The fellowship, the first in Western Canada, will be led by Dr. Evan Wood from UBC. 20 doctors will be trained in the program over the next 5 years. It is hoped that the new training will help to address many of the addiction and mental issues that plague the downtown east side. In Dr. Evan Wood's words, quote, "This is something that was needed decades ago. We know that drug and alcohol addiction is a disease and that there are effective treatments and can help people recover and go on to lead productive lives," end quote.
Vancouver City Council is demanding a meeting with the Prime Minister over the slated closure of the Kitsilano Coast Guard Station. The closure would shift the burden to respond to marine emergencies onto fire and police boats and leave safety gaps, according to a report presented to Vancouver City Council on Tuesday. Deputy City Manager Sadhu Johnston said the closure would stretch the resources of the police and fire departments beyond the scope of their mandates. The report found the closure would translate into a 25% cut in Coast Guard staff and a drop from 6 to 4 vessels available 24 hours a day in the 64-kilometer radius around Vancouver. The KIPP station responds to 75 to 100 calls per year in which lives are in danger or potentially in danger. If it closes, all of those calls will become the responsibility of the Sea Island Coast Guard station in Richmond, which is at least 30 minutes away by boat.
Vancouver Police Department spokesperson Sergeant Randy Fincham told media on Tuesday that $9,000 in cash has been stolen from the Vancouver Pride Society and another $3,000 was snatched during the Vancouver Taiwanese Festival. The person of interest in both thefts is the same woman who volunteered at both festivals under a false name. Police have released photos of the woman in the hope that someone will be able to identify her. The investigation continues and police are pleading with anyone with information to contact them. For our listeners, the photo and more information can be found on the Vancouver Police Department website.
And now we have our follow-up interview with four volunteers who participated in the Great Canadian Shoreline Cleanup over the weekend.
But first, we're going to take a quick break, so do stay with us for that interview.
Showbox and Union Electronic present Orbital live in concert at the Vogue Theater on Wednesday, September 26th. Orbital has returned with their first new album in 8 years. Called Wonky, it puts a vividly modern spin on their signature blend of richly melodic, deeply emotive electronica. Advance tickets are available at B Street Records, VogueTheater.com, or UnionEvents.com. Doors open at 8 p.m. All ages are welcome.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts in the Main Street area at
Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Devil May Wear, Flaming Angels Boutique, Lucky's Comics, Neptune Records, Red Cat Records, The Regional Assembly of Text, RX Comics, Temple of the Modern Girl, and the Wallflower Modern Diner.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To learn more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus or check us out online at citr.ca.
All right, now we do actually have our interview with the three volunteers who participated in the Great Canadian Shoreline Cleanup over the weekend. Hi, guys. If you could introduce yourselves.
Hello, my name's Jocelyn. I'm grade 11, and I decided to do the Great Canada Shoreline Cleanup this Saturday.
I'm Priscilla. I'm in grade 10, and I'm from Burnaby North Secondary.
And I'm Peter. I'm in second year from Langara.
Awesome. So, you guys, what was your personal motivation for joining this effort?
Well, my personal motivation was because our good friend Peter here decided to get us all together and, help our shoreline and clean up.
Service hours.
For me, it was, I guess it's because living in a city like Vancouver, we get the best of both worlds, and we get city life and also what nature has to offer. So I guess I just really wanted to help out the city and also help out the future generations.
Wow, that's noble. How did you guys get, how did you hear about the program? Like, how did you get involved?
Well, we got involved because this program is actually advertised a lot around Vancouver. And this program, we've been hearing about it since we were kids, really. But we've never honestly taken the initiative to actually do it. So we decided maybe, you know what, like, let's try it out.
Cool.
See what happens.
My school has an environmental program. And so our club actually advertises this a lot. And we promote it via word of mouth on Facebook. And that's how I got into
cool.
it.
For me, the shoreline cleanup was always in the back of my head, but so I guess one day when I was looking to do volunteer work, I googled the words "volunteer in Vancouver" on YouTube, right? On Google, and I guess the words "the Great Canadian Shoreline Cleanup" came up.
That's really cool. I'm assuming you guys enjoyed your weekend. And what was what was the most interesting thing that you guys picked up?
The garbage can, the concrete garbage can that had rolled down the slope or something.
Oh. Wow.
Yeah, we didn't really pick that up. It was kind of there. We left it there because you can pick it up because it's concrete. But we found syringes.
Okay.
Yes. And so
what was the most common thing you guys were finding?
It was cigarette butts.
Oh, okay.
Gross. That got really annoying really fast.
And so, like, are you guys planning on continuing with these kind of green projects throughout the year?
Yeah, you know, like, green projects, we do them daily, but a big project like this, we have to, takes time and commitment. So if any do come up, we will join and participate. But little things we will do to help keep green, yeah.
Do you guys have any specific tips on things you guys do on a regular basis?
Buy clothes with pockets, because that way you can put your garbage into the pockets and we don't have to clean it up next year.
Peter, do you have anything?
I guess recycle and carpool.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right on.
And I'm just wondering a bit about the shoreline cleanup. I mean, obviously you guys had a great time, learned a lot, found some really cool things. Who were the people who were doing the shoreline cleanup? Did you feel like a lot of it was people who were high school students, university students, or more of a cross-section of Vancouver? I mean, what was the turnout like?
There is actually a big variety of people. There were people who were really actual activists, and there were also high school students and, you know, families as well. They're just, honestly, it's just people who do want to get together to help out and clean up, because this is our home. They just really want to do it, and it's really a huge variety of people, so, yeah.
And Peter, at the beginning, you touched on the point that, you know, this is Vancouver and we're pretty lucky to be living here and have those differences. Did you guys feel that maybe the awareness of the Great Shoreline Project has increased and it's become more of a Vancouver thing, or do you think it's still for a certain set of people and that this needs to be, I guess, growing in awareness a bit? Any of you?
This project certainly has grown throughout the years. When I was a kid and I heard about it, like, no one really knew what to do, but now, you know, we're older and there is a lot more awareness to it, and that's how Peter over there found out about it.
It's almost not a duty anymore. It's fun. I met a complete stranger and I had a, like, 5-minute conversation with her, which was interesting. And I think it's more like an outing now instead of you have to do this.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that shift in mindset is important for people in Vancouver to take in? Like, it's more of a fun thing and not necessarily a chore.
I think that would mean a lot more people would come and clean up, which is good for the shoreline. So,
yeah. You know, Vancouver is listed as one of the greenest cities on the earth. So, you know, it helps that it is. Yeah. And it helps that, like all of us are, you know, helping, pitching in to contribute to this title of being one of the greenest cities on the earth. So it's getting there. Yeah, for sure.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for...
Wait, I was just going to say, are you guys planning on doing this next year?
I am.
Definitely.
Sure, why not?
Okay, awesome. Bye.
Well, yeah, thanks so much for coming in and taking the time to talk to us today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having us. Yeah.
Thank you.
So once again, that's Jocelyn, Priscilla, and Peter, who were talking to us about the Great Canadian Shoreline Cleanup that happened over this past weekend. And we are going to take a quick break, but please do stay with us for your provincial and national news as well as your weather report.
The Rio Theatre is your independent East Vancouver theatre, playing first-run feature films, independent film screenings, as well as live events. Every Friday night, there are featured midnight cult classics on the big screen, and no one can beat the Rio for their cheap date Tuesdays.
Every Friday night, 11 p.m., see movies like American Psycho, Grease, and the Rocky Horror Picture Show. Special events this month at the Rio include a tribute to the Beatles on Friday, September 14th, Wonder Woman, the untold story of the American superheroines on September 19th, the Olio Festival from September 20th to 22nd, a Yes Men double bill hosted by Mike Bonanno on September 27th. And on the last Wednesday of the month, join us for the critical hit show Dungeons & Dragons, a live comedy experience. And if you're an aspiring filmmaker, get your entry in for the Rio Grind Film Festival. Deadline for entries is October 15th.
For more information on all this and more, check out theriotheatre.ca.
Wow.
Welcome back to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM. It is now time for your weekday weather forecast with UBC Storm Club's Phil Chang.
Hello. Thank you, Claire. Wow. Weather this week. In my opinion, we will be experiencing a period of gloominess, actually, over the next 3 days, as a large low center made landfall in Alaska recently. What does that have to do with anything related to us? Well, join me in imagining the cell as an ice skater who is doing a counterclockwise spin. While the ice skater, the cell, is very far away from us, this particular individual has super long arms, 20 latitudes long from north to south, effectively 2,000 kilometers. So as you can imagine, as the system spins, we are being brushed in our faces, active weather. And that is why the cell is so very relevant to what's happening in our city this week. It's one of the prime reasons why I suspect why our data collection and processing station started projecting thick and long-lasting patches of clouds starting today. What does this all mean? If the model is right, we should still get a little bit of sun, but only intermittently. And finally, one other notable local weather feature the cell is inflicting upon us is our wind. Air parcels around us are actually gushing out right now from the land towards the ocean to fill that low, that vacuum over the ocean. This means that wind speeds here on UBC campus tonight is predicted to be a high of 15 kilometers per hour, with occasional gusts blowing up to 25 kilometers per hour. All because of that one cell. Great. So now let's take a look at Environment Canada's official weather prediction for this week. Today, mainly cloudy, high of 18, UV index of 4 or moderate. Tonight, partly cloudy, fog patches developing before morning, low of 10. Tuesday, mainly cloudy, clear early in the afternoon, fog patches dissipating in the morning, high of 18. Wednesday, a mix of sun and cloud, low of 11, high of 18. Thursday, also a mix of sun and cloud, low of 10, high of 19. And finally, Friday, a mix of sun and cloud as well, with 40% chance of shower. Oh dear, that probably means the cell is sending more than just clouds our way now. Precipitation as well then. Alright, so low of 12, high of 17. Alright, so that sums it up for this week. Thank you for listening. From the UBC Storm Club, reporting for News 101, I'm Phil Chang.
And thank you, Phil, for that. PSAs? Okay, we've got a quick break for PSAs, but stay tuned.
Saturday, October 27th. Union Events presents Alan Stone live in concert with special guests Kingsick and Yuna at the Vogue Theater. Stone mixes elements of pop with soul and gospel into a soul-soothing sound, so don't miss his last Canadian tour stop. Tickets are $20 and can be purchased in advance through Zulu Records or online at unionevents.com or voguetheater.com. Doors open at 7, all ages are welcome.
Welcome back to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM. It is now time for our provincial and national headlines.
The University of Victoria will be celebrating its 50th anniversary starting on Friday through till next June. The celebrations include musical performances and various events meant to draw attention to the research done at the university as well as its strong sports legacy. The university evolved from both Victoria College, which dates back to 1903, and the Victoria Provincial Normal School, now the Lansdowne campus of Camosun University, or college, sorry. UVic President David Turpin says, quote, "This is a wonderful opportunity to celebrate 50 years of achievement, to honor the generations of faculty, students, staff, and alumni who have built UVic into a university that is recognized around the world for its excellence," end quote.
Britain and Canada will establish joint diplomatic missions and share embassy offices abroad, Foreign Secretary William Hague is set to announce. Mr. Hague will reveal more details of the plan when he meets his Canadian counterpart, John Baird, in Ottawa later, a Foreign Office spokesperson said. The proposals involve co-locating embassies and sharing consular services in countries where one of the nations does not have an embassy, the spokesman said. Mr. Hague and Mr. Baird will sign an agreement and hold a press conference later on Monday to explain more about the plans. Ahead of the meeting, Mr. Hague said, quote, as the Prime Minister said when addressing the Canadian Parliament last year, quote, we are two nations but under one queen and united by one set of value, end quote. We have stood shoulder to shoulder from the great ways of the last century to fighting terrorists in Afghanistan and supporting Arab Spring nations like Libya and Syria. We are first cousins. So it is natural that we look to link up our embassies with Canada's in places where that suits both countries. It will give us a bigger reach abroad for our businesses and people for less cost, end quote.
BC Premier Christy Clark has been forced to replace her Chief of Staff, Ben Bosenkul, after an internal investigation into a quote-unquote incident of concern. In a statement to the media, Ms. Clark named a successor, former BC Hydro Chair Dan Doyle, but provided no details about the events that led to Mr. Bosenkul's resignation. Earlier this month, the Premier's office was made aware of an incident of concern. Since that time, a review has been undertaken that adhered to the processes set down by the BC Public Service Agency. Having considered this review, I accepted the resignation of the Chief of Staff, end quote. He said that he will return to Calgary to be with his family, whom he had been separated from for nearly 8 months. Ms. Clark remained mum during a news conference on the matter Monday morning, citing privacy laws. She did, however, state she was made aware of the incident of concern about 2 weeks ago. There has been no indication of any criminal conduct.
And those are our provincial and national headlines for News 101. It is now time for our international headlines with Democracy Now.
More coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Anti-U.S. government protests continue in Muslim countries, angered over a U.S.-made amateur film mocking the Prophet Muhammad. In Pakistan, at least 21 people were killed and more than 200 wounded Friday when thousands took part in nationwide rallies that turned violent. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton appealed for calm inside Pakistan.
I want to thank the government of Pakistan for their efforts to protect our embassy in Islamabad and consulates in Lahore, Peshawar, and Karachi. And I want to be clear, as I have said numerous occasions, the violence we have seen cannot be tolerated. There is no justification for violence. Of course, there is provocation, and we have certainly made clear that we do not in any way support provocation.
More protests were held over the weekend in countries including Iran, Greece, and Bangladesh. The New York Times reports the deadly attack on the U.S. consulate in Benghazi, Libya, during protests there against the film has seriously hampered CIA operations on the ground. Following the deaths of U.S. Ambassador Christopher Stevens and three of his staff, more than a dozen CIA operatives and contractors were evacuated. They've been gathering intelligence on armed groups operating in and around Benghazi. The Libyan government has said it only became aware of the U.S. intelligence operation after seeing the number of operatives being evacuated. The bomb administration has released the names of 55 Guantanamo prisoners who've been cleared for release. The names are part of a group of 86 prisoners who received approval to be transferred from Guantanamo 3 years ago, but have remained in captivity. Guantanamo defense attorneys say the disclosure will make it easier to advocate for those identified, but have urged the U.S. to reveal the remaining names and begin transfers without further delay. Republican candidate Mitt Romney's released a limited set of personal tax records following months of public criticism. Romney's 2011 tax return shows he paid an effective tax rate of 14% on gross income of $13.7 million. But the return also shows Romney gave $1.75 million in charitable deductions so as not to contradict his claim he's never paid below 13%. Keeping the deductions would have meant a tax rate of 10%. But forgoing them also contradicts his previous statement. He wouldn't be qualified to be president had he ever paid more taxes than he owed. Although Romney continued his refusal to release full tax returns from previous years, a letter from his accountants say he paid a tax rate from 1990 through 2009 of at least 13.6%. Speaking on Fox News, former White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs criticized Romney's secrecy on his tax returns.
He gave his accountant 20 years and he gave the American people two. Chris, what's he hiding? Why does he have corporations in Bermuda, investments in the Caymans? Why is somebody who says they're going to get tough on China investing in the Chinese state oil company and banks in China? I think the American people deserve to know a lot more about Mitt Romney's finances because he hasn't been straight with the American people about those finances, and he hasn't been straight with the American people about their what's going to happen with their taxes.
Campaigning over the weekend in Virginia, President Obama told supporters the change he's pledged in Washington will only come with the mobilization of ordinary Americans.
You can't change Washington just from the inside. You change it from the outside. You change it because people are mobilized. You change it with the help of ordinary Americans who are willing to make their voices heard because the decency and the goodness and the common sense of Americans. We don't want an inside job in Washington. We want change in Washington. And from the day we began this campaign, we've always said that change takes more than one term or even one president, and it certainly takes more than one party. It can't happen if you write off half the nation before you even took office.
A prominent human rights lawyer known for defending peasants in Honduras has been assassinated. Antonio Trejo was attending a wedding when he was shot to death just outside the church. Trejo represented several peasants' rights groups and their struggle against wealthy Honduran landowners. Hours before his death, he'd spoken out publicly as part of his vocal opposition to plans for privately run cities in Honduras with their own police and tax system. The government of Ecuador has offered a new proposal to the British government in their standoff over Julian Assange, the founder of WikiLeaks. Assange is currently taking refuge in the Ecuadorian embassy in London in a bid to avoid extradition to Sweden to answer questions over alleged sex crimes. Ecuador says it has asked Britain whether Assange could be sent to Sweden under its protection, which would thereby protect him from the threat of further extradition to the United States. A former Guatemalan army commander accused in a 1982 massacre has been extradited from Canada to the United States to face charges he lied about his past to obtain U.S. citizenship. Jorge Sosa was allegedly a commanding officer during the notorious Dos Eres killings when a U.S.-backed death squad killed more than 200 villagers, including women and children, who were strangled, beaten with sledgehammers, and thrown down a well. If convicted, Sosa could be returned to Guatemala to face charges thereafter serving his sentence. Rioting has broken out at the notorious Foxconn factory in China, known for the poor treatment of workers who help make Apple products such as the iPhone. Foxconn says a personal dispute among the workers led to clashes involving some 2,000 of them, leaving 40 people injured. And the federal government's opened a criminal probe of Chevron's oil refinery in Richmond, California, after discovering the company funneled pollutants away from monitoring equipment and instead burned them off into the sky. The discovery came at the same plant where a massive fire sparked blazing fires and a health scare for surrounding residents last month. The alleged rerouting of the pollutants meant federal monitors have had no way of knowing how much pollution was emitted into the air and towards residents living downwind decommissioned from the plant. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're on our 100 city tour back in New York City. On Wednesday, I'll be speaking at the University of Connecticut.
And thank you to Democracy Now! For those headlines. We're going to take a quick break, but stay tuned for some stories from Free Speech Radio News.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
And welcome back to News 101. I'm Morgan Yee with Claire Eagle and Siraj Mahajan. And you're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver or online at citr.ca. Thank you for being with us. And it's now time for some headlines from Free Speech Radio News.
World leaders from nearly 80 countries met at the United Nations General Assembly today, with some saying states should recommit to the rule of law as a way to prevent war. The UN envoy to Syria, Lakhdar Brahimi, spoke in New York after briefing the UN Security Council and warned of a worsening situation in Syria. The UN General Assembly begins its annual debate tomorrow. On the ground in Syria, fighting continues. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights put a preliminary death toll today at 70 and reported government bombing in Aleppo and street gunfire threatening residents in Damascus. The Syrian Network for Human Rights said it documented 81 killings on Sunday, most from shelling and sniper fire. The deadly airstrikes are destroying critical infrastructure, putting a heavy toll on civilians. In some places, residents have little access to food, water, and safety. FSRN's David Enders reports from northern Syria.
The city of Abu Dhahr, in northern Syria, abuts a military airport of the same name. Its 30,000 residents mostly fled after the Syrian government reduced entire parts of the city to rubble with airstrikes following a rebel attack on the airport. Muaz is an anti-government media activist in the area who gave a tour of the destruction.
We took out 30 bodies from under the rubble. Most of the people living in this area were refugees from other parts of the country.
Further north, rebels continue the fight for the country's largest city, Aleppo. Aleppo, as well, is emptying of civilians. In addition to the risk of being hurt or killed by shelling and airstrikes, residents also lack food. Outside a rebel-run bakery in Aleppo's Hanano neighborhood, hundreds of people stand in line waiting for bread. Despite the risk of being attacked, one young woman said there was no other choice.
We are not afraid. They are shelling us 24 hours a day. We have no bread, no food. There's no water, no electricity. We are poor people. We have nothing. Everything is off.
Inside the bakery, a spokesperson for the rebels said that they were providing 10,000 bags of bread a day.
It's possible that we may be shelled. Many bakeries have been shelled. Four or five times bakeries have been shelled. These are volunteer workers. The revolutionaries provide the fuel and the wheat.
But despite such efforts, many are simply choosing to leave. Umm Abdo was fleeing the fighting and shelling with her children.
We haven't eaten yet today. We have no village, nowhere to go. I have five children. I don't have enough money to even buy bread for them. We go to sleep afraid, and we wake up afraid. I only came to talk to you because I was hoping you would give me something for the children. The owner of the house will kick us out if we don't pay the rent.
The alternative to remaining in Aleppo is not particularly pleasant. On the Turkish border, some Syrians attempting to flee the country have been trapped for weeks, as Turkish authorities say room is running out in the camps that already house tens of thousands. Hamza Hamza is one of those who is trapped.
We have been here for 15 days under the trees. Every day, they say, next Sunday, next Thursday, you will be let in. But you can see it isn't happening. There is one family under each tree. Except for the Free Army bringing us bread, we don't have anything.
Nonetheless, the people camped here said they were relieved to have escaped the violence. As they waited to cross into Turkey, the only certainty seemed that they would be joined by more. David Enders, FSRN,
Over the
Syria.
Weekend, protesters drawing attention to hydraulic fracturing or fracking met in cities in the U.S. and across the world as part of coordinated protests called Global Frackdown. Protesters staged events in Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, Culver City, California, and Nova Scotia. Photos online showed protesters gathered in Galway and Belfast in Ireland and in front of the Eiffel Tower in Paris and the Ministry of Ecology in the Ukraine. Demonstrators also gathered in South Africa, where the government is facing stiff resistance against its plans to move forward with hydraulic fracturing. Some 96,000 square miles of the country could be opened for shale gas exploration. From Cape Town, FSRN's Davison Mutsingwa reports.
Earlier this month, South Africa's Minister for Mineral Resources, Susan Shabang, announced that the government was ready to move forward with fracking and would be lifting a moratorium on the practice. She said the government will review license applications for shale gas exploration in parts of the country.
It took us all over 1 year for us to conclude this process, and we are satisfied that we've given sufficient time for us to consider the matter of hydraulic fracturing. And the report presented indeed and taken to cabinet informed the cabinet of the decision which they've made.
The announcement alarmed environmental groups concerned that fracking will become a reality. Jonathan Dewey has become a leading voice of resistance against fracking in South Africa.
We are perplexed about the sequencing and the logic of lifting the moratorium, the so-called moratorium, and in the same breath announcing that public participation will take place.
Like opponents around the world, South African residents are concerned that fracking will lead to health and environmental hazards. The process uses water and chemicals injected deep underground to extract hydrocarbons from the rock. The national government instituted a moratorium on shale gas exploration in 2011, following fierce criticism from civil society groups. But officials lifted the ban earlier this month, following a recommendation from a government task team. Five companies, including petroleum giants Shell and Canadian-based Falcon Oil and Gas Limited, have applied for licenses to explore at least 20% of the country's land.
Those are the companies which we'll consider in terms of our regulatory framework.
The minister said the government will proceed with caution, but Deal says this is a gamble the country cannot afford to take and a legal battle is looming.
And we will wait and see as the exploration application unfolds, the applications for exploration licenses. If and when they are issued, we're obviously going to review the terms and conditions and the criteria around that, and that will assist us in framing our appeals. But the road forward at this stage, unfortunately, looks as if it's clearly headed towards court.
As government, we have a responsibility to defend decisions we take. If we are taken to courts, we will defend, because we have to defend a decision we have made. So we can't abdicate our responsibility.
Everyone, wanna drink gas?
No!
Our right to clean air!
At the National Parliament in Cape Town, anti-fracking activists chanted and sang against the government's move. The protest was part of a coordinated worldwide campaign called Global Frackdown.
It is a day to send a message, that South Africans send a message to our government, that we are not prepared to be pushed around by the international mining industry.
Not to fracking!
Not to fracking!
Not to shell!
Not to shell!
Not to fracking!
Not to shell.
Demonstrators in South Africa denounced Shell for committing $200 million to the exploration of gas. They said such money is better used in pursuing greener options such as solar.
We say to them, spend that on a Karoo job with solar energy.
An assessment by the Petroleum Agents of South Africa concluded that as much as 3 trillion cubic feet of shale gas may be recoverable from the country's underground. The industry also estimates that fracking will create thousands of jobs. But according to IOL News, the government-funded Water Research Commission has warned officials of the risks of fracking, including widespread pollution of groundwater, mini earthquakes, and privatization of parks and other state land. Advocates are especially concerned about one of the proposed fracking areas, Karoo, an expansive arid grassland that is 2-hour drive from the coastal city of Cape Town. Apart from groundwater contamination, activists say the Karoo's endangered species of plants, animals, and birds will also be affected. Lawyer and environment campaigner Paul Hoffman says government leaders need to more carefully assess the repercussions of fracking.
Can we afford it in a water-scarce country to put a large part of our water resources in jeopardy as a consequence for the hunger for natural gas?
While the government reviews applications for exploration, activists say they will take the matter to the Constitutional Court if necessary. Defson Mzingwa, FSRI in Cape Town.
In Israel, a local religious women's rights group has filed the first ever class action lawsuit on the issue of gender segregation. Orthodox Jewish feminist organization Kolek is suing a radio station for excluding women's voices. The group says it hopes the step will protect women's rights in Israel's public society. FSRN's Jillian Kessler-Damore has more from Jerusalem.
Women in Israel's ultra-Orthodox communities have long faced discrimination. In Jerusalem, there is segregation on buses and sidewalks, and some health clinics are divided along gender lines. Advertisements depicting women are rarely seen in the city anymore. Large signs urge women to dress modestly if passing through ultra-Orthodox neighborhoods. But for local group Kolech, the first Orthodox Jewish feminist organization in Israel, banning women's voices from the radio airwaves is one step too far. Kolech recently filed a $26 million class action lawsuit against the Jerusalem-based ultra-Orthodox radio station. The organization argues that the Kol Berama radio station discriminates against women by forbidding women's voices from being heard on any of the station's programs. Ricky Shapiro is a Kolech legal advisor and board member.
People forget that 50% of this community are women, who doesn't have any choice to let them voice be heard. That's why the issue of this Kol Berama is very symbol. It's their voice in the radio station. It's their voice in the world. No, nobody sees them and nobody hears them. When people will understand that it's going to cost them a lot of money, we hope that things are going to change.
Such separation is outlined in Jewish religious laws and in centuries-old religious texts. In response to the lawsuit against it, the Kol Berama radio station called for respecting, quote, the beliefs and outlook of the majority of the ultra-Orthodox community, according to an article in the Jerusalem Post. But not everyone in the Haredi community supports the exclusion of women from the radio station. A 37-year-old ultra-Orthodox man from Jerusalem spoke to FSRN on condition of anonymity.
The radio station doesn't give a voice to women, even when women are the issue being discussed. It's a shame that their voices are being silenced. I think that you should do everything you can legally to stop those attempts to silence women. It's a very good thing because there is no logic or justification to silencing women's voices, and it leads to a very bad place.
Recently, this gender division has seeped into the public sphere. In July, a court awarded a teenage girl more than $3,000 after two ultra-Orthodox men forced her to sit at the back of a bus, despite the fact that gender separation is illegal on public transportation in Israel. The incident occurred in Beit Shemesh, a town located about 20 miles from Jerusalem, which has been a hotbed of religious-based harassment and intimidation of women. In December 2011, an 8-year-old Israeli girl was spat on for supposedly dressing immodestly while on her way to school. But awareness of the issue is growing, Attorney Orly Erez-Likovsky works at the Israel Religious Action Center, a branch of the Reform Judaism movement in Israel. She said that media attention and public condemnation has led to a decrease in instances of gender segregation over the past year.
People have started to realize that it's not gender segregation is not only happening in ultra-Orthodox neighborhoods, and there is this slippery slope that if you allow the practice of segregation in one place, it would penetrate to other places as well. And I think people have started to realize the dangers in it. It's happening everywhere, and that this is why it's so important to stop it.
In a report released in January 2012, the Israel Religious Action Center documented over 50 cases of gender segregation that took place in Israel last year. In August, Israeli bus company Agid quietly decided not to use any images of people in advertisements featured on the side of buses in Jerusalem. Israeli media reports stated that the company made the decision to avoid offending the city's ultra-Orthodox residents should the ads feature women. The feminist group Kolech is currently waiting to hear whether an Israeli court will accept its lawsuit as a class action case. The organization is trying to make its case by using a survey of Kol Berama's listeners, showing that 40% of people were offended by the fact that women were not allowed to speak on the air. Jillian Kessler-Damour, FSRN, Jerusalem.
The controversy surrounding the anti-Islamic film produced in the United States and cartoons published in France has spurred a debate on freedom of speech around the world. Some have called for the Innocence of Muslims trailer to be removed from YouTube, including an actress from the film who filed a lawsuit after receiving death threats. But a judge ruled Thursday that the film, at least for now, can stay up. The trailer was blocked in a number of countries, including Pakistan, whose Prime Minister called today for the United States to draft a law that would ban hate speech, aimed at fomenting hatred and sowing the seeds of discord, according to the Express Tribune. In France, traditionally a strong defender of secular values and freedom of speech, the government banned protests today. This followed publication of caricatures of the Prophet Muhammad in a weekly newspaper. The French Ministry of Foreign Affairs also ordered the closure of its diplomatic offices and schools in 20 countries, fearing the same level of violence that has led to the deaths of dozens of people. FSRN's Khaled Sid Mohand met the chief editor of the French magazine that published the cartoons and gathered the reactions of Muslims living in Paris, the biggest Muslim community in Europe.
Disgraceful, hateful, useless and stupid. That's how Dalil Boubker, rector of the Grand Mosque of Paris, described the cartoons printed in France's satirical weekly Charlie Hebdo. Several Muslim organizations in the country also say they will file lawsuit against the publication. Mokhtar al-Maghrib is an Islamic bookshop owner who hasn't seen the cartoons and doesn't want to know anything more about them. But he does support a legal response to the offensive material.
I personally don't give much importance to it, but we have to take legal actions against the magazine. Just like the American movie released on YouTube, which I haven't watched and don't want to, but one must sue these people because we are French and we have rights and duties.
Many Muslims approached by FSRN declined to be interviewed, citing past experiences in which French media outlets have distorted their perspectives and acted hostile to their community. But 51-year-old baker Ridal Juma agreed to share his views. He says he's using the principles of his faith to guide his response to the intolerance.
As a Muslim living in Europe, where freedom of expression is beyond everything, I think that if they don't want to respect the religion of others, it is their right. It can drive some people to express bad reactions, and it's a pity, because they shouldn't feel offended. The Prophet Muhammad has always been persecuted and insulted, but he has shown patience. He has been an example of wisdom. It has nothing to do with breaking and burning. Islam is based on tolerance and good behavior.
On Wednesday, the satirical French magazine Charlie Hebdo published several controversial cartoons, one of which depicted Muhammad naked in a demeaning pornographic pose. The publication's chief editor, Stéphane Charbonnier, said that the cartoons were not a provocation and he won't take responsibility for the violence of others.
According to what happened last week when this trailer has been released on YouTube with its consequences in Libya, I mean, dozens of people have been killed. You could expect such violent reactions today.
Yes, but I don't care. I'm not in the street with a
Kalashnikov or stone to kill other people. I'm just a drawer. And if people want to go in the street to kill other people, they can do. Withdraw, without draw, it's not a problem for us.
But for some, the cartoon is just another example of bigotry and prejudice. Kamel Wali works in an upscale cafe in eastern Paris. After seeing a couple of clients laughing at the drawings, he said he tore up the magazine he just brought an hour earlier.
I felt like we're always the targeted community. They just despise us. They hate us. I am not a devout person. I don't care about religion. I don't pray. I don't fast. But when I see such drawings, I really feel despised, and I feel like shouting, I am Muslim, and f*** you all.
Others also see the country's deep-rooted problems with intolerance. Pierre Thévagnon is a high school philosophy teacher and author of numerous books on Islam in France. He says Islamophobia is a form of racism.
Of course, Islam is not a race in itself. It is a religion. But since we amalgamate, we stigmatize, we focus on this difference, we generalize a group of people in order to make them homogenous. Then we're getting close to what could be called racism, and it eventually becomes racism when, in addition to that, and it is a determining factor, targeted people face all kinds of social discrimination, then it is definitely racism.
French police banned demonstrations Friday against the cartoons and the controversial U.S. film as a precautionary measure after calls circulated on social networks to street protests. Muslim leaders also urged people to refrain from demonstrations, and thousands gathered peacefully to pray. Khalid Sid Mohand, Free Speech Radio News, Paris.
Thank you to Free Speech Radio News for those international headlines. More headlines and their full podcast can also be found at fsrn.ca.
.org. And that's our program for September 24th. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved, or give us an important news tip, contact us through our email, news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews and segments on our website, citr.ca/news, or look for us on Facebook at News101. For more independent news, join us on Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Morgan Yee.
And I'm Claire Eagle. Today's show was produced by Chirag Mahajan. From the entire news team here at CITR, thank you for listening. Stay tuned for Sore Throats Clapping Hands right here on CITR 101.9 FM.